This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The word vegetarian was coined in the 1840s, but vegetarianism is much older, and over the years, people with all manner of political views have advocated a meatless diet, including Descartes, Bacon, Shelley, Tolstoy, Gandhi, and Hitler. Our guest this afternoon is Tristram Stewart. He is the author of The Bloodless Revolution, A Cultural History of Vegetarianism from 1600 to Modern Times. In the introduction, Stewart says that in the era before the Industrial Revolution, the question of meat eating, quoting here, was one of the fiercest battlefronts in the struggle to define humanity's proper relationship with nature. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Tristram Stewart. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And we have a toll-free number as well. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Tristram Stewart is a freelance writer who has worked for a number of Indian newspapers. A 1999 graduate of Cambridge University, he served as a contributing editor and researcher on a book about Himalayan nomads. His book, The Bloodless Revolution, A Cultural History of Vegetarianism from 1600 to Modern Times, is his first book. The publisher is W.W. Norton. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Tristram Stewart, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon, Celeste.
How are you?
Pleasure. I'm very well, thank you.
Good. When did people begin thinking about this question of whether or not to eat meat?
Oh, well, the true history of vegetarianism, as it were, goes back thousands of years, not just hundreds. In ancient Greece, the philosopher Pythagoras believed in reincarnation, and he taught his followers to not kill animals on that account. In India, of course, the ancient religions of Hinduism and Jainism and Buddhism all have vegetarianism as part of their system. So it really goes back for as long as you can really find records. But really, in Europe, in the West, there was a flourishing of vegetarianism from the mid-17th century, from the 1600s, and that really had a boost in the late 17th century when Europeans went to India and encountered vegetarians there. Mm-hmm. That triggered a great deal of debate in the West about what the proper relationship between humans and animals was. And since then, really, a vegetarian tradition has flourished in the West ever since.
Oh. And in the mid-17th century, the interest in vegetarianism had to do a great deal with a very bloody war, not a bloodless revolution.
Well, that's absolutely right. Cromwell's Civil War, of course, was the breeding ground of a lot of heretical and dissenting sects of Christianity and political movements. But out of the that climate of turbulence grew this movement that rejected the bloodshed that they had experienced during the war. There were several veteran soldiers who actually fought in Cromwell's Civil War, the radical end of Cromwell's alliance against the king. And they turned against bloodshed for exactly the reason that you just mentioned, the fact that they had experienced so much of it. And they turned against blood in such a severe way that they even rejected the shedding of animal blood. They also saw meat as a representation of luxury. The luxurious aristocratic elite ate meat conspicuously, and they aligned themselves with the poor who couldn't afford meat. And, you know, they took a moral abstinence choice as a result of that.
Yeah. I suspect that when most people think of vegetarianism today, they think of people who are concerned with health, with the welfare of animals, sustainability, and the health of the planet. Have these also been among the concerns of vegetarians through history?
Absolutely. All of those concerns go back, especially to the 17th century. Most of the arguments for vegetarianism that people are familiar with now were carved out in the 17th century, in the 18th century, during the Enlightenment especially. The arguments for health were there, the religious reasons, the ascetic reasons, the reasons for health. All of those were there And they were developed by philosophers and thinkers and politicians and the rest of it during that period. And what we have today is the flourishing of the tradition that really started back then.
Hmm. The book contains many illustrations that help illuminate the relationships between people and animals. And in the book's second set of plates, we see an 18th century painting, Girl Weeping Over Her Dead Canary. Would you tell us something about that connection between people and animals over the course of history?
Well, that's a very complicated set of ideas. What you have there is a really typical representation of human sympathy for animals. Now, that's something that a lot of people would argue is natural to humans, to have some kind of sympathy with their fellow beings that obviously also have feelings and obviously also experience pain. And when you observe a human feeling pain, you have most of the time some degree of sympathy for them. Likewise, when you see an animal feeling pain, people recoil. Most people would not engage in useless torture of an animal because they see that as just cruel and pointless, and why would you do it? But the interesting thing about the growth of sympathy for animals in the West is that it coincides with this at the same time with the growth of factory farming. So in fact, you could say that the growth of sympathy for animals per se was not enough to protect animals from being eaten by humans. So that especially during the 18th century, what you find is that some of the most outspoken advocates of sympathy for animals were also outspoken opponents of vegetarianism. They thought we should have sympathy for animals, but not in so far as, you know, vegetarianism. They thought that we shouldn't go so far as to deny ourselves the right to kill animals. We should just kill them as sensitively and humanely as we possibly could.
Hmm. And also,
that's something that we're familiar with today.
Yeah.
You know, in the meat industry, people talk about free range and happy chickens and the rest of it, and that the idea of being able to eat meat without hurting your conscience because you're not causing animals to suffer goes back to the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And through representations such as the one that you just mentioned.
Yeah. The idea that this, the factory farm, the fact that this moving away from the apparatus of bringing food to market, how has that affected our ideas? I mean, it's sort of like out of sight, out of mind.
Well, that's exactly one of the things that I look at in the book,
yeah,
is how precisely the sympathy for animals that people are really started to encourage everyone to feel during the 18th century also encouraged them to move abattoirs, the site of slaughter, out of the shambles. It used to be done in the open air at the market. If you went to market to get your meat, you would also be likely to see animals being hit on the head with sledgehammers and their throats cut. And that was something that Georgian Londoners and everywhere all over Europe was really very familiar with. But people started to object to that. They didn't like to see the animals being killed. And partly as a consequence of that protest, slaughterhouses went indoors and out of town. And once they become out of sight and out of mind, as you say, the welfare of animals is less carefully looked after, so that you get the growth of factory farming and the complete neglect of the feelings of animals and their welfare.
Hmm. Where do you think we are today in that regard?
We are at the very height of the exploitation of animals and the neglect of their welfare and also of our own welfare. As a recent UN report shows, the growth in the appetite for meat is putting one of the most severe strains on the environment from, compared to any other sector. The consumption of meat is driving deforestation, it's driving soil erosion, it's driving overconsumption of water, excessive energy use. All of those things can very often be traced back to the consumption of meat. It's actually a very inefficient way of using our resources. If we grow grains and then we feed them to cattle, most of the nutrition in those grains is wasted, and yet a third of the arable product of the entire world is given to animals. Now, you know, most people would say that that's not an argument in itself for vegetarianism, and maybe it isn't, but it's certainly an argument for reducing our consumption of meat and taking into account our own interests alongside the interests of our planet.
Hmm.
When we decide what we're going to eat.
How many vegetarians are in the world today? Do we know?
Oh, I have absolutely no idea. And it depends what counts. I mean, do you include someone who lives in a very poor country and cannot afford to buy meat? Are they a vegetarian or are they just impoverished and malnourished? You know, personally, I don't find that a particularly interesting question. The question that I find interesting is how much meat are we eating and can we do anything to reduce that?
Yeah. How much meat are we eating and can we do anything
to... 50 billion animals a year are raised and killed for various reasons,
At the same time, though, there is this, it seems to me that we're being sold once again, you know, we are treating the animals more, with more respect, free range, and the these kinds of things are being sold to us. Well, and we're also hearing about the benefits of vegetarianism as in terms of health.
That's absolutely right. But just as at the 18th century, when these ideas of free range and, you know, healthy raising of animals and the giving of some respect to them, they go hand in hand almost with also a neglect for other animals that we don't get to think about so much. So, for example, you might have even a free range cow, but it's being fed perhaps on soya that has been grown on the deforested Amazon rainforest. So while you're considering the welfare of one individual cow in the States or in Europe that you're raising on your farm and you're giving that cow the best life that you possibly can before it gets slaughtered, you're neglecting the welfare of the rainforest, which you're chopping down to grow soya to feed it. And I think that's a really big paradox that we have to deal with. And of course, free range, organic, all of those things, they're far better than the feedlots and the factory farms that produce most of the meat that we eat in the West. But it's still not taking the whole ecological issue into consideration. And that's the thing that motivates me when I think about, you know, the impact of meat production. Of course, I care about the individual welfare of animals on the farm. But what really concerns me in a more holistic sense is the impact that we're having on forests, on our own resources, and really the whole planet.
What's your interest in the history of vegetarianism?
Well, I'm very interested by this question. Why do we love nature and care for it, and yet at the same time destroy it, sometimes totally necessarily? And I think that's a burning question that we have to really face up to now. We're facing such huge ecological problems that finding out why our culture has created nature in the way that I just described, where we care about it and we destroy it, finding out the history of that idea, the history of our culture that's produced, you know, the way we live today, is instrumental in also finding a solution to that very problem.
One of the things that you note in your introduction is this: understanding the history of our ideas sets modern culture in a striking new light and can overturn our most entrenched assumptions.
Well, I think that's right. If we understand where our ideas have come from, that can help us to see a way around those ideas, see how we can change them. It puts them into a relative sense with many other ideas. Here's the way that you might think about your relationship with animals, but there are all these other ways of thinking about it, and maybe that would change your point of view. Certainly it changed mine.
What were the most surprising discoveries you made as a result of looking at this history?
Well, that's very simple. The biggest revelation for me was the extent of the impact of Indian culture on the West as early as the 1600s. I had absolutely no idea before starting the research that in the late 1600s, when travelers first went to Europe and wrote about Indian vegetarians that they encountered in India, that had triggered such an extensive philosophical and cultural debate back in the West. It really was the touchstone for all debates about, well, for many debates about our relationship with animals. People would say, well, you know, we do this in Christendom. We neglect our animals and we allow them to suffer and we eat them without any consideration for their welfare. But in India, they live in harmony with all the animals, and that's really a model that we should consider in our relationship with animals too.
What led to that fascination with Hinduism?
Well, I think that precisely because it was such a radical challenge to the Western idea of human dominion over animals. So the Bible had quite explicitly said that man had dominion over all other things in the world. And although the Bible implies that humans were not supposed to eat animals until after Noah's flood, so before that we were supposed to be living on herbs and fruit and the rest of it, it makes it absolutely clear that at least after the flood, God has given us absolute right to kill and eat animals. And that was really the idea that most Westerners had fixed in their mind, that we had the divine right, there was no need to question it. When we went to India and we started encountering Hindus who had a totally different idea of their relationship with animals, so that animals had some kind of value in and of themselves and that it was good to practice non-violence towards them, that was such a different way of interacting with the environment that it naturally triggered this, sometimes appalled, sometimes it triggered ridicule. So Europeans went over to India and they ridiculed the vegetarians, but very often it caused Europeans to really reconsider what they had assumed was the right way of treating animals.
Yeah. That ridicule continued well into the 20th century at least.
Well, it did not just continue, it actually flourished in the early period of early colonialization and the even pre-colonial encounter in India. People were very much more open to ideas of Hinduism than they were later. In the 19th century, it became much less acceptable to admire Hindu doctrines such as vegetarianism, and in fact, ridicule for Hindu vegetarians grew, such that even by the 20th century, when Gandhi was growing up, he grew up in the late 19th century, but he carried these ideas through into the 20th century. He thought that Hinduism, when it taught vegetarianism, was actually effeminate, and he believed that actually Indians would need to give up their vegetarianism and start eating meat if they were to defeat the British. Ironically, it wasn't until he came to London and encountered vegetarians in London that he became convinced that actually vegetarianism was a source of strength and a way of protesting against British imperialism.
Hmm. You mentioned the passage in Genesis, dominion. On the other hand, we have the golden rule, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Do these two things taken together help explain this bifurcation that we have, this non-thinking way of putting this together?
Well, of course, most people would, during the 17th and 18th century, most people would not have applied the golden rule to animals. They thought that it only applied to humans. So the relationship between humans and humans, and the relationship between humans and animals was totally different. However, there were some vegetarians who argued that, in fact, animals did come under the remit of the golden rule, and they frequently said, do unto others, including animals, as you would be done by. That's absolutely right. But what they saw in the Bible was, so there was the divine mandate that really we could eat animals. That came after Noah's flood. But what the vegetarians focused on, and this is really where the friction and the bifurcation arose, what the vegetarians focused on was the fact that in Eden, we were not supposed to eat animals. And they argued that that meant that in God's original plan for the perfect world, we weren't going to eat meat. And that eating meat was nearly a sign of the fall, and even some argued that it was a cause of the fall and of the corruption of humanity. And so what a lot of people argued is, if you want to get back to that perfect state where everyone lives in harmony, you have to start by taking up the diets that Adam and Eve followed in Eden, and that was vegetarian, and most people agreed with that.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer Tristram Stewart. He is the author of The Bloodless Revolution, A Cultural History of Vegetarianism from 1600 to Modern Times. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The phone number's in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, we have a toll-free number if you'd like to join us. And that number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, we've mentioned Eden now, or you have, and that brings me to ask you about a fellow by the name of John Robbins. This takes us back to the English Civil War from 1642 to 1649 and its aftermath.
Yes, well, John Robbins, or the Shaker's God, as he was known, he didn't just say we should live like Adam. He actually claimed that he was a reincarnation of Adam and that he had come back to Earth and was going to bring about the end of the world and the judgment of all souls. And he believed that he had impregnated a woman whom he called Mary with a reincarnation of Jesus. And really, he fitted his whole argument into the biblical prophecies of the coming of Christ for the second time. And although he may have sounded wacky and unreal, he actually managed to collect around him a very large following, well, large compared to what you might expect, and several of them were arrested and put in prison, and some of them even resisted the attempts of the government to put down his movement and continued to proclaim the name of John Robbins as being divine and the rest of it. Of course, John Robbins, when he was arrested, he flaked out and went back to the country. But in the meantime, he had started a movement which had vegetarianism as one of its principal elements. So he argued precisely that, that if his followers were going to get back to the perfection that Adam and Eve enjoyed in Eden, then the first thing they had to do was live on the Edenic diet of bread and apples. And in his wake, there were several other vegetarians with similar radical religious ideas who felt the same, that if you are going to return to the perfection before the fall, then you had to be vegetarian.
Yeah. What a cast of characters here.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, you get these eccentrics on the one hand, but at the same time, you get the mainstream philosophers. So even while John Robbins was ranting and raving, you get the likes of Descartes and his great rival, Pierre Gassendi, who are looking at the scientific questions surrounding vegetarianism. They're looking at human teeth, and they're saying, well, actually, our molars indicate that we're more like herbivores than carnivores. And so that suggests that nature has designed us to be vegetarian. And so you get this great variety of discourses and different characters, all really coming to similar conclusions.
Yeah. Another figure from this period is Roger Crabb.
Well, Roger Crabb is an extraordinary character. He may well have known John Robbins. He lived at roughly the same time and started becoming a vegetarian activist in the 1650s. He grew up in London and he didn't grow up in London. He grew his sect in London and went off to be a hermit in Uxbridge and was often put in the stocks for inciting all the people of Uxbridge to break the Sabbath laws and all sorts of other heretical things that he encouraged them to do. But vegetarianism was, again, his central doctrine. And he really hated all meat eaters and was very uncompromising in his attitude. But his ideas got into print. He published a number of pamphlets and he collected around himself, again, a bunch of followers, and articulated new and very interesting biblical arguments for vegetarianism. He went through the whole Bible and picked out every passage he possibly could to try and prove that God really wanted us to be vegetarian.
Mm. Well, one of the things that you quote in this chapter on him is very interesting. According to one newspaper, Crabb claimed that meat made the body a dunghill, filling it with gross humors and snaky diseases, engenderers of lust, sloth, and melancholy, that so corrupt the senses and bodies of men and women that take aside a little reason, there is no difference between them and brute beasts. So he also is saying that if we eat animals, we are no better than animals.
That's right, and that really raises one of the very interesting paradoxes, or what appears to be a paradox, in the history of vegetarianism. What you find, and you find it in Roger Crabb, you find it in several other people too, is that they do argue that we should be nicer to animals because animals aren't just dirt. They have feelings and, you know, we should be kind to them. But at the same time as valuing the life of animals, they also see animals as dirty and as a source of potential corruption. And for that reason, they don't want to eat their flesh. They say if you eat an animal, you will become like it. It will awaken in you all the beastly instincts. So that's what he means by the snaky diseases and lust and luxury. He thinks that if you eat animals, you become bestial. And so for ascetic reasons, he avoided eating flesh so that his soul would escape from its bestial body. And that's something that really recurs. And it's also, interestingly, something that occurs in Hinduism, where you find a similar paradox, where animals are a source of contamination, but they're also seen as more valuable and as worthy of respect. Mm. So, yeah.
What would one have found on Britain's tables in the mid-17th century?
It depends which tables.
Yeah.
On the tables of the poor, you wouldn't have found very much meat, but on the tables of the rich, it was piled higher than you can possibly imagine. In the 18th century, especially, the conspicuous consumption of meat became really a status symbol, and especially beef, which became synonymous with the British character, beef-eating and beef-eaters. And so really there was a great deal of national pride going into the consumption of as much meat as you possibly could, and they ate it by the pound, and often without anything else, with maybe a bit of bread, but vegetables were seen as superfluous and often quite suspicious, and the causes of indigestion and the rest of it, so that it was a really a big uphill struggle led by the vegetarians, even to prove that humans needed to eat vegetables, you know, as a nutritional requirement. Mm. And that was something that was proven eventually during the 18th century, because, of course, if you don't eat vegetables, you come down with scurvy. And it was the vegetarians who helped to foster the recognition that nutritionally vegetables had things that humans absolutely required as part of their diet.
Yeah. How did people begin to think of a diet that included vegetables or a diet that was meatless as something that was healthful?
Well, that was the scientific struggle that the vegetarians of the 18th century particularly faced, is proving that you could actually live without meat. Before that, most people thought that at least for virility and strong labor, you needed some meat. It was the thing that soldiers absolutely required, barrels of beef and the rest of it. And that was despite a great deal of evidence, of course, from peasants and the rest of it who worked hard and yet didn't eat very much meat. But the real watershed, again, was India, because when Europeans went to India and they saw that millions of people lived without ever eating meat, that really put to the end the recurrent argument that you couldn't live without eating meat. So again, the empirical evidence of vegetarians in India was extremely important for Europeans trying to prove that the vegetarian diet was viable.
Mm. And that did that lead to a large number of Europeans or some significant number of Europeans taking up a vegetarian diet?
Well, it's impossible, again, to estimate how many vegetarians there were during the 18th century. And again, it depends what you include. The number of moral abstainers from meat was probably quite small. But the large numbers of vegetarians come under the remit of those who were prescribed vegetarian diets for medical reasons. It became an extremely common, even an orthodox idea, that the cure to many diseases, from gout to rheumatism to scurvy to the rest, lots and lots of diseases had as their cure the vegetarian diet. They were seen to be relieved by abstaining from meat. And so doctors across Europe prescribed their patients by the hundred to go through periods, at least, of abstaining from meat. And many doctors thought that once you'd given up meat for a while, it was actually unsafe to take up meat again. So there were Europeans in their droves who were practicing it from this medical dietary perspective, and it's incalculable how many there were. But really, proportional to modern days, I would say it's easily comparable.
Is there evidence for this in art and literature of the period?
Absolutely. You find novelists and artists who represent exactly what I've just been talking about. So you could look, for example, in my book, there's a caricature of King George III, who was a renownedly frugal person. And this is an audacious caricature by Gilray, but it represents the king and the queen sitting at their breakfast table eating a vegetarian diet. This was partly because they're frugal, but if you look in the bottom right-hand side of the picture, there's a book by this man, George Cheyne, who was the foremost vegetarian doctor in Europe. And so what it's implying is that the King George is following the dietary prescriptions of this vegetarian doctor. Now, this vegetarian doctor, George Cheyne, also happened to be the doctor of Samuel Richardson, the father of the English novel. So he was the author of Pamela and Clarissa, books not read very often now, but really which founded the whole genre of the novel, or helped to, in a very significant way. And Richardson was put onto the vegetarian diet of George Cheyne and practiced it for much of his writing career. And what you find is that Richardson gave to his own characters, Clarissa among them, his own vegetarian diet, so that you find this trickle down from medical discourse into novels, into life, and it becomes an extremely widespread idea. And vegetarianism becomes associated with virtue, the virtue of Samuel Richardson's characters. And then you find that Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who read Richardson's novels, gives his heroines, who are modeled on Richardson's heroines, also gives them a vegetarian diet. And Rousseau builds that into a radical philosophy of animal rights. And that really triggers the whole animal rights movement during the French Revolution and beyond. So it's a really significant movement that gathers pace. And it comes out of the medical tradition, it comes out of the encounter with India, and it comes out of philosophy and the relationship between humans and animals, and that all merges during the 18th century into this profound and very interesting and varied movement that we now know as vegetarianism.
The idea is fascinating, that vegetarianism is alongside and intermingled with political struggle. Maybe you would expand on vegetarianism and the rights of animals and animal welfare in the French Revolution.
Well, that's exactly when that whole thing takes off, is during the French Revolution, when people were seeking the extension of the franchise so that all people would be enfranchised within the political system. There were a number of vegetarians who were followers of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau had said that, obviously, all humans had political rights, but he also argued that we owed some degree of obligation towards animals. He wasn't himself a vegetarian, but he did say that we should not cause animals to suffer without a good reason. Now, it's questionable whether he thought eating meat was a good enough reason to kill animals. He, as I said, ate meat himself. But elsewhere in his works, he did actually say that meat was unnecessary. So there were a number of vegetarians who extracted from Rousseau's philosophy a vegetarian manifesto of radical political rights for people and the protection of animals from being eaten. And a number of vegetarians joined the French Revolution with exactly that manifesto. So you get John Oswald, who actually went out to India. He converted to vegetarianism in India, and he came back and he published a fascinating text, The Cry of Nature, which adapts Rousseau's philosophy into a radical animal rights philosophy. And there were a number of other people at the same time who held similar views, and which the modern animal rights movement owes a lot to, but also the moderate vegetarians that we're all familiar with.
Any role in the American Revolution?
Well, Benjamin Franklin is America's most famous vegetarian, and he first became vegetarian as a result of he was a printer in his early career, as many people know. And whilst printing, he came across these early texts, the 17th century books of a man called Thomas Tryon. And Thomas Tryon is really my favorite character in my whole book. He grew up during the period of Cromwell's Revolution and became a vegetarian. And then he started reading the texts of Indian travelers. And that's when he discovers about the Indian vegetarians. And he becomes a follower, more or less, of Indian vegetarianism. Now, it was those very books that Benjamin Franklin read and converted to vegetarianism. If you read his autobiography, he discusses at length his trials and tribulations of being a vegetarian. So he actually breaks his vegetarian rule once when he's on a ship and cod are brought up, and he smells the cod in the frying pan, and he remembers how fond he was of cod when he would still ate meat. And he thinks, no, I can't eat it. You know, I'm Master Tryon, my teacher and the philosopher who I admire, would have taught me that was murder. But then he thinks, well, hold on a sec. I remember when I saw the guts of those cod taken out of their bellies, that there were lots of little fish inside their bellies. And then he thinks, well, hold on a sec. If it's all right for the cod to eat other fish, surely it's all right for me to eat the cod. And that's how he breaks his vegetarianism. Yeah.
Are you a vegetarian?
No, I'm not. As I say, the principal reason that motivates my whole interest in this subject is our impact on the whole of the planet and the world's ecosystem. And I do say that the way that we produce meat in the modern industrial farming system is extremely damaging to the world's ecology. It's damaging to our own interests. And therefore, I don't purchase meat that comes out of that system. But I do believe that there are some ways that you can produce meat which is sustainable and, in fact, can cause less suffering to animals and less ecological damage than even ordinary arable agriculture, the production of bread. And one of those, which is very controversial and, you know, a lot of people have a difficulty with it, which I perfectly well understand, but is hunting for wild animals.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in parts of the UK and I believe also parts of the States, there are very, very large numbers of deer. The natural predators have been killed by humans already, and so the populations grow extremely large. And I do think that it's okay to cull them and to control their population and, of course, therefore, to eat their flesh. So that's where I differ really fundamentally from many vegetarians. I totally advocate the vegetarian diet. I think it's absolutely a sensible response to human neglect of other animals and the whole planet. But I don't actually think it's the only necessary moral outcome from a concern for the planet and concern for animals.
Yeah. It is interesting. I remember several years ago being in a situation where I was covering a hearing, and it was taking place in a rural community, and there were a lot of big city folk in town for the hearing. It was also deer hunting season, and the hearing was taking place in a building next to the meat locker. And it was a very interesting juxtaposition of two ways of being in the world. Because the deer that were coming to the meat locker and were being dressed, they were part of that community's sustainability. I mean, it's not a wealthy community.
Mm.
And it was also interesting. It was also a way for families to come together.
Mm.
And inside the building where the hearing was being held, that was totally foreign.
Mm.
It was, you know, very interesting. And yet, you know, here were people who were earning, you know, upwards of $300 an hour for their services, you know, very well shod.
Mm.
And they were appalled.
Yes. Well, this is it's a paradoxical thing. I mean, hunting has been vilified, often quite rightly, because it has often been pursued in the name of sport, so that animals have been killed just for the sake of killing them. And that, of course, is morally indefensible. But there's a very clear distinction in my mind between that sort of hunting and the hunting which is for food. And it can be a sustainable quest for food and more sustainable than a lot of agricultural practices that people don't necessarily associate with ecological damage or suffering of animals. And I think one of the interesting examples that often clarifies this in my mind is if you think of nomadic herders of animals, so for example, Siberian reindeer herders or any number of herders in the world, there's actually a symbiotic relationship between the human and the animals that they herd. Neither the humans nor the animals could survive without each other. And I think that, you know, a lot of vegetarians who haven't necessarily considered every possible angle would think that even in that case it's wrong to kill a reindeer. But I can't share that particular conclusion. I totally agree that we need to consider the welfare of animals, but I think if you often look at it in a wider ecological perspective, it's morally acceptable to eat some sorts of meat. But really the thing that I want to emphasize is that one of the biggest problems that we face on this planet is the industrial meat industry, and I think there are big problems with that. And before people start defending meat eating, they need to sort out the problems in the meat industry and the ecological and social damage that it's causing all over the world.
We've talked about a number of interesting characters that you have written about in the Bloodless Revolution. Let's talk about, before we have to wrap up, a couple of others, perhaps. Or maybe you would like to pull out from this cast of characters people who, from history, think as you do about vegetarianism, and that is as a matter of, as an ecologist.
Well, I have a lot of sympathy with Benjamin Franklin's argument that I just described. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's exactly the traditional argument that was made, is that we live in an ecosystem, and to try and separate us from the whole ecological system is a misunderstanding of our place in nature, and that what we have to do is do it sustainably. So Franklin is one. I have a certain degree of sympathy with a number of characters in my book, but actually I have to tell you that I don't wholly agree with any of them. None of them represent my personal views, partly because the ecological problems that we face now weren't principal concerns back in the 17th and 18th century. So there's not really one character that I can put out and say this is my point of view. Those strands of argument are all there and come together in my ideas. So, for example, in the late 18th and early 19th century, the likes of Percy Bysshe Shelley, the poet, he and his fellows started to worry about the inefficiency of animal agriculture, and they pointed out that it takes 10 times more land to grow the same amount of food in meat as it does to grow an amount of food in grain. So if you wanted to eat meat, you had to chop down 10 times more trees and cultivate 10 times more land. You would never be able to feed as many people as if you all just ate grains. And I think that is a very important idea.
Yeah.
And one that I think we can listen to even now while we're destroying forests all over the world.
How did Thoreau's thinking about eating meat, what was the development of his ideas on the subject?
Well, he had exactly the issues that we've just been discussing. Mm-hmm. He had a very ambivalent relationship with the idea of vegetarianism. So on the one hand, he really did see himself as a wild man living in the woods, living as part of the ecological system that we described. He did hunt and he did prey on animals, and he relished that relationship of hunter and prey in his life. But on the other hand, he did say that he thought that a higher life, one separated from the meanness and cruelty in nature, was the vegetarian diet, and that would be the diet that poets and philosophers might want to follow in order to lighten their mind and loosen their mind and become more enlightened. And that was often the practice of his own in his own life.
There, we'll leave it. We're out of time. Tristram Stewart, thank you very much for talking with me.
Thank you, Celeste. Goodbye.
Tristram is the author of The Bloodless Revolution, A Cultural History of Vegetarianism from 1600 to Modern Times. The publisher is W.W. Norton.